great chef, and Tracy Luckow, who is the Global Insights and Innovation Director. Mm-hmm. Are you a director?
I am.
She directs it.
We're going to find out what that title means.
Sabra is in with all the details, and we're going to be doing some hummus dipping here shortly.
We got lots of hummus in studio. And so yesterday, David and I took the kids, and we went apple picking and pumpkin picking and tomato picking. The fields are still filled with tomatoes, and I cannot wait to start canning. And I'm so excited because later in the show...
I cannot wait to start not canning.
Well, you won't be doing it with me. But later in the show, we'll be talking to Marisa McLennan because she is known as like the can-do canner, but she's all about small batch canning. So we're going to find out a little bit more about that and how we can start doing that throughout the entire year. So
all right, and then we're going to get political and serious
because
the Nonprofit Chef Action Network, or CAN, was created to give back to the chefs.
Oh, more canning.
Who not only cook from their souls, but who want to get involved in, you know, in the world around us with policymaking and other issues. CAN focuses, this is from their materials, but they focus on harnessing the power of America's preeminent chefs. In support of a strong, sustainable, just, and healthy food system, which we are for and all about. Mm-hmm. And CAN's founder, Catherine Miller, is here, and we're going to hear all about it.
I'm very excited for that conversation.
And you might say, well, what's new at Fabio Trabocchi's fabulous Fiola in Penn Quarter? Well, among the many things that are new are master mixologist Casper Rice. He joined Fiola after a hugely successful run at the Inn at Little Washington with
Patrick
O'Connell.
You're just like a name dropper, Casper. It's like Fabio Trabocchi, Patrick O'Connell. Who else? Anybody else you want to drop a name of?
My first job was with Larry Stone in San Francisco, Master Sommelier.
Okay.
All right, you know, you're killing my buzz here.
Sorry.
Because I've got more to say.
Go ahead.
So he's going to be in mixing up cocktails, faux cocktails, I guess, mocktails.
Mocktails.
Because we can't have booze in the studio. Darn it. Mm-hmm. But he brought in Lauren O'Leary, who's their lead bartender, who's all gussied up for radio. Go figure, just like Nikki. Mm-hmm. So why don't we start with you guys. Casper, give us your background a little here.
So my background is cocktail and wine. And
you mean even as a small child?
I was raised in a biker bar outside of Chicago.
Did you ever get picked up for drunk driving your tricycle or anything?
Close.
Oh, I see. All right, I'll let you talk.
Okay, go ahead. You're 411. Let's hear it.
So, okay, I grew up in Chicago, moved to San Francisco in 2003 mm-hmm. to get into the wine scene, and kept that pretty close with cocktails as well, mm-hmm. and was there for about 12 years, and came out to the East Coast.
So what's your wine training?
Through the Court of Masters, through learning with Larry Stone, mm-hmm. and after he retired, I went to work with Rajat Par with the Michael Mina Group for about mm-hmm. 7 years.
Sure. Great. And then what?
It's like going to Harvard.
I know. No. And then so what brought you into the cocktail part of it? Because that's such a huge scene right now.
Just interest, I think.
Mm-hmm. So what is it that interests you exactly?
How they mix together and how, you know, so many different products can become one final.
Mm-hmm. And so going into Fiola, you know, they already had a fantastic cocktail program in place. How did you go in and put your touches on it?
Well, slowly, you know, I've been there for about 2 months, mm-hmm. and so we're slowly, you know, getting our bearings regrouped, and so we're starting to do with fresh and seasonal kind of things moving forward with just like fresh apples, seasonal fruits.
Okay, so give us an example of something you'll be making.
So like what we're going to do today is going to be first autumn harvest, which is going to be a couple ounces at the restaurant it will be, not
right.
here, of course.
Right.
a couple ounces of Templeton rye, mm-hmm. a little bit of Amaro. Some Cointreau. Amaro is a bitter liqueur. Cointreau being...
Amaro is very hot right now. I'm seeing that on a lot of cocktail menus. Why are so many people playing with it?
I don't know. It's delicious.
Okay. That's the easy answer.
Yeah.
I was going to say, no lawyer asks a question she doesn't already know the answer to. You go. All right. So you're whipping up. What do you got?
So, yeah, we got this. It's first autumn harvest, which is going to be a little bit of rye, some Amaro, Cointreau, fresh lemon, and... Angostura bitters,
mm-hmm.
so pretty seasonal, pretty, you know, autumn in a glass, I guess you could say. And
I like that, autumn in a glass. Mm-hmm. You're a poet.
What we're doing here, we're going to make a classic kind of cocktail and then top it with a really spicy kind of cinnamon foam that we do with nitrous.
All right, well, I'm going to hope that that goes with hummus because that's what we're going to talk about. And Trace, so what I mentioned that Tracy Luckow is here from Sabra. And, you know, in the Middle East, hummus is to pita bread what peanut butter is, or I guess was, to Wonder Bread. I mean, it's ubiquitous, and it's on everybody's plate and in everybody's house. I was in Israel in the early 70s. I'd never heard of hummus. We stopped at a little stand, and I'd never seen pita bread either at that point. Pita and hummus and just diced fresh cucumber and some tomato and some carrots, and it blew my mind. It was delicious. And I, was jamming it into me for the 6 months I was there. But let's start with the basics, I guess. What is hummus?
Well, first of all, thanks so much for having me. It's really fun to be here. Hummus.
And I paid you to say that.
Yes. Hummus is essentially chickpeas and tahini with some salt, some garlic, basically herb spices. Mm-hmm. At Sabra, we like to put a lot of garnish on top, too. So you see like a lot of fresh vegetables on top or spices.
Pine nuts.
Yeah, pine nuts, roasted red peppers. Garlic, mm-hmm. But it's just, mixed together, and it's delicious.
Well, how did hummus go mainstream? I mean, it's like all of a sudden, is it because...
We were talking about it before. Yeah. Everybody in studio was talking about, the first time they had hummus. And I said, when I was in college, because I went to a Greek restaurant mm-hmm. in college, and they always had hummus and tzatziki and baba ganoush on the menu. So I know that was my first experience. But as we were talking earlier, it was like, when did you start buying it and bringing it home?
Yeah.
So what do you think how do you think that all started?
Well, I think, the point that you're bringing up, your trip to Israel, your first time in college, I mean, this is really where a lot of the passion and excitement is around hummus, mm-hmm. is that it's one of those rarer or newer foods to America. Mm-hmm. So people really have a very good memory of their first time, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Mine was also in college. I remember my roommate introduced it to me, and we stayed up all night and we were talking, and it just brings back great memories, whether it's, in college, your first time having it, or whether it's a trip, it's very transportive. But I think, in grocery stores, it's really just started in the last 5, 6, 7 years.
Well, it's got to be really healthy for you, because there's almost, it's
chickpeas, beans.
It's,
right.
It's beans, it's a little lemon, a little olive oil, a little salt and pepper.
Yeah, I think that foods that are really popular right now are ones that have a lot of nutrients in one small bite.
Mm-hmm.
So whether that's yogurt or whether that's hummus, the things that are really nutrient-packed are the ones that are kind of, gaining the most popularity right now.
Well, plus you guys are running I don't know if it's a national campaign.
I assume it is.
Yeah. I wish I had the media buy. Come on.
We'll talk later.
All right, so you guys are doing something that's unusual for really sort of a manufacturer. You're doing a pop-up.
Yes.
Here in D.C. opens tomorrow.
Yeah, what's the process of what is the pop-up? What is it looking to do?
Yeah, so it's a full sit-down restaurant for 4 weeks in D.C. Mm-hmm. And
what's the address?
It's 1254 Wisconsin.
Okay.
And the reason that we're in D.C. is a few things. Number one, it can't be ignored how much the foodie scene has grown here.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a great place to get, food influencers and really be a part of the scene.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I don't know if you know this, but we have a huge factory in Chesterfield County, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty close to here with about 500 employees, and we're expanding it. So we'll have more and more, all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really kind of close to us, to be part of the community where our employees were.
Do you do it way out in Chesterfield so no one can hear the cries of the chickpeas?
You're mushing them off.
Whipped into submission.
Yeah. We'll talk about the political impact of that later.
Cruelty to chickpeas.
But so is it going to be a full-service restaurant?
It's a full-service restaurant.
What does that mean? Tell us about
you
the menu, what's going to be in there.
Yeah, first of all, it's really beautiful, I have to say. But
okay.
You walk in and you sit down and, we have a lot of shared tables because hummus is one of those foods that you really can share with people and dip in together.
Not when Nikki's in the room. Get your hands off my hummus.
But we really want to create that very intimate.
For the record,
unhand that hummus.
I love sharing. I am a huge sharer, and I like to grate. Hummus and the tzatziki and the baba ganoush, all the things you brought in today. I'm a grazer. Mm-hmm. I like to dip, and I like to hang out. And I'm in fact, the more and more, and I think lots of restaurants are doing this too, is that you're seeing more and more ability for people to graze as opposed to just an appetizer and an entree.
Absolutely. And our foods are perfect for that. So mm-hmm. we have, at Sabra, we sell not just hummus, but we also have, Greek yogurt dips like tzatziki. We have guacamoles and salsas. So all of our products are very fresh, but they're very shareable and grazed.
I don't remember guacamole in Israel.
How does guacamole and salsas, is that just what is Sabra? What is their company's...
Our mission?
Yes.
So we're really all about fresh healthy foods, and bringing, you know, tastes from around the world to the U.S. So all of that's the reason why we've expanded to other foods.
So are there chefs at the restaurant, and am I getting like lamb with my tzatziki, or how will it
You're
work?
Not getting lamb, but certainly we are incorporating hummus into dishes you wouldn't expect, like tostadas. We're using it as spreads on things like paninis. We're introducing some garnishes you wouldn't expect, like pumpkin seeds and, you know, za'atar. So things that are more Sounds traditional like fun. To Israel. But also we have some things that are just like really, really basic. Like my favorite is the warm hummus. And it really is like a trip to Israel, so to speak.
Why? Because most people don't eat hummus warm.
Correct.
We all eat it cold. So what is it about it? And why should we be eating our hummus warm? Are we all eating it wrong?
We're not all eating it wrong. There's no wrong way. But definitely what we want to do is introduce new ways to experience this food. And certainly it tastes so different warm than it does cold. Just like a soup, you know, if you have a gazpacho, it tastes different than a tomato soup that's hot. So it's really, you know, bringing a new taste profile to the food.
Wait, we have to take a break.
Well, wait, I know. In a second, Hummus House will be open for how many weeks?
For 4 weeks.
4 weeks.
All right. Well, we'll get some more details, like who's going to be cooking there and the kinds of dishes are going to be there when we come back. This is David and Nikki Nellis with Foodie and the Beast. We'll be back in just a sec.
You're so annoying.
You're so annoying.
Stop copying me. Mom, tell her to stop copying me.
Mom, tell her to stop talking to me.
Kids will spend 10 minutes copying everything their sibling says.
You're such a doofus.
How about 2 minutes to brush their teeth? Brushing for 2 minutes now can save your child from severe tooth pain later. For fun 2-minute videos to watch while brushing, visit 2min2x.org. 2 minutes twice a day. I have the time.
Mom!
A message from the Partnership for Healthy Mouths, Healthy Lives, and the Ad Council.
GovEvents.com is your one-stop shop for government and military events worldwide. With hundreds of event organizers posting their government and military-related conferences, trade shows, expos, webcasts, and more, you'll save time and energy using GovEvents to find events to attend, exhibit, or sponsor. Search for government and military events by date, location, keyword, organizer, or focus. It's free, so join today. GovEvents.com. That's GovEvents.com.
This is Mark Amtower. If you're looking for cost-effective and efficient methods for marketing your products or services to the government or to other government contractors, look to LinkedIn. There are over 400,000 members in the D.C. area and more than 92 million nationwide, but only a small percentage actually use it well. I can show you how to leverage LinkedIn in ways that support your marketing, sales, and business development efforts. I do this for large and small companies, and I can do it for you. Drop me a line at mark@federaldirect.net.
When you do all your activities, the IP address they see is the IP address of the proxy server. Because you see, it's called a proxy server because you send the request to that server and it actually makes the web request on your behalf. The website that's being contacted actually only sees the IP address of the proxy server. There are some proxy server systems that are designed to really be super anonymous, so they'll even hide your identity even further.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
All right, we're back on Foodie and the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis. We're talking to Tracy Luckow from Sabra about the Hummus House pop-up that opens tomorrow in Georgetown on Wisconsin Avenue. And you were talking about the menu and you were talking about the sharing of dishes. Let's talk about Mary Beth Albright and the other folks that will be cooking there.
Sure. So we're really lucky to have Mary Beth Albright from the Food Network Star. She will be in the restaurant every day. Helping us, you know, to not only, you know, create the dishes, but also share the story of what hummus is all about to everyone who comes in. And also we'll have, you know, lots of events where we'll invite in other chefs to come and cook with us on Wednesdays at noon.
Okay.
So for demos and things like that.
Now, you guys open for lunch and dinner?
We are. We're open 11 to 3 and then 5 to 9.
And do people make reservations or do people just pop in? How are you working this pop-up?
Yeah, you can make reservations, but we like to be informal as well. So it's really a house and everyone's welcome whenever they want to come in.
Okay, very cool. Well, it sounds terrific and very different. Is this the first place you guys have done this kind of concept?
Yes. So we have done...
Is this your idea?
She's like, it's all mine.
I may get into big trouble.
Okay.
So please come. So we have a very long history of having these trucks that go from town to town, city to city, and mm-hmm. hand out samples. Mm-hmm. And it was really time in a true entrepreneurial spirit to think about what the next iteration of bringing samples are to people. And so mm-hmm. we wanted to have a better experience, a more in-depth experience, and really show kind of the versatility and stretch that you could have with this food. So having a sit-down meal seemed like the perfect opportunity.
Perfect. I think the next is a hummus mobile touring the neighborhoods. Wouldn't that be great? The bell ringing.
Right, instead of ice cream, hummus.
Blowing the shofar and calling the people to the hummus truck. All right, well, let's give the address again and make sure everybody knows. Is there a phone number to call for reservations?
Or is there a Twitter handle to follow?
You can go online. So at sabra.com, you can find our menu and all the details of our address. You can also look on Facebook and on Twitter at Sabra Hummus House.
Okay.
And we're 1254 Wisconsin.
Cool. Excellent. Thanks so much for coming in. Thanks for bringing in all the delicious.
Yes.
Sure. Thanks
hummus.
For having
Be sure
me.
To leave it.
Right. Are you kidding?
All right. So let's go back to Casper and Lauren. Guys, we were talking about some of the featured cocktails there. Got a question because there's such a huge competition now between all the mixologists in the city to be creative and to do things that they're not, where they're not replicating some other cocktail artist stuff. Is there a danger that you just get too caught up in your own fumes and you start serving stuff that's just too over the top? Have you found that as a problem?
I think you can find that as a problem, but a lot of times I know when I'm making a new cocktail, I'll go to Casper for more advice and mm-hmm. be like, I like this, what am I missing? I'll use our pastry chefs, go to them, and they always have like a great recommendation or a pairing that goes with what you want to play with.
So there's no pride of authorship. I think what David's asking is, I mean, we've had some mixologists in studio before where it's just how Coco Chanel says, take one thing off before you leave. Like, do you ever find that sometimes you're just adding too much?
I always take off my pants. Just for fun.
Aren't you all lucky he kept them on today? Do you know what I'm saying?
I think too many variables in a cocktail makes, the bottom line kind of muted a little mm-hmm. bit. So I think keeping it simple, but in the way that I find wine, good balance.
Okay.
So if you have like the alcohol, the sweetness, the bitter, the acid, all that, it's got to be there and it's got to be perfectly balanced. That's the most important thing.
What I think is incredible is that when you talked about the first drink that you put together, and I know we don't have the alcohol in here to make the changes, it sounded like it was going to be super sweet and sort of sticky, but it's really clean.
You need the sweetness a little bit, but right. it can't be shining. It's got to mm-hmm. be there. It's balanced by the bitterness and the acid. So it's not a ton of sweet.
You're a mad scientist, aren't you?
You are. All right. So what are you concocting next?
So let's do something we keep very seasonal. We're going to do what we call adult sodas.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll make a couple different variations here. We're doing blueberry and a white peach.
Oh.
And so all we do is take fresh fruits, cook them down for several hours, take that, strain it out. Add a little bit of cream, and then we top it with champagne.
Well, the fresh fruits cooked down. What a great segue to the next subject.
I know, exactly. Thank you.
Marisa McClellan is the author of Preserving by the Pint. It's a new cookbook about quick seasonal canning for small spaces, which really translates to urbanites and suburbanites who are not out on the farm and they're going to be canning for the whole winter and all that. Marisa, are you there on the phone?
I am here.
Hi, welcome to Foodie and the Beast.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, so we're really excited to talk to you because it is canning season. And as I was reading through your book, I think a lot of people are afraid of canning. It just seems so labor intensive. How do you sort of talk people out of that fear?
Well, first of all, it's only labor intensive when you're trying to put up enough that, you're going to, if you have a huge garden or you're trying to get through the winter. Most of us aren't trying to can enough to get through the winter now. And so,
right. Most of us live near a Whole Foods or a grocery store or a farmer's market.
I'm trying to get through the winter, but that's just because I'm old. Right. I'm just hoping to make it through the winter.
But it really becomes something where you can do it for fun, you can dabble, you can explore. And so I approach it from really small batch, from the really small batch perspective. And so when I write a recipe, and particularly all the recipes in this book, I'm looking at creating recipes that start with sort of these very small amounts of produce that are easy for us to pick up. So every recipe in the book starts with either a pint, a quart, or a couple of pounds of produce, which is the amount you get at the farmer's market or in a CSA share, what you can pick up at the grocery store, or if you have a little backyard garden, what might be coming to you. And so instead of needing to devote hours and hours or a whole weekend to a recipe in order to can, my recipes take about an hour. So you can really play around and experiment and know that you're not making this giant commitment to a preserve when you do it in small batches.
So how did you become a canning fanatic? I mean, nobody wakes up in the morning and says, I think I'll can. How did that happen? And then how I'm also interested in the sort of the transition to understanding that so many people live in cities and suburbia and they're really not canning for the winter. And it just seems like such a daunting task to do it in a small batch. How'd all that happen?
Yeah. Well, I grew up in Portland, Oregon, and we always had apple trees and blackberry bushes around us. And I grew up in the city, but we would can a couple of times a year, whether it was having gone blueberry picking or making blackberry jam from the berries down the street. So I grew up knowing how to do it. And then about 8 years ago now, I was living in Philadelphia by that point, and I went blueberry picking with a friend, and I came home with 13 pounds of blueberries and went, oh, my God, this is a lot of blueberries.
Because that's bigger than some babies.
Yeah, exactly. You know, because when you're out in the field, you're picking, it doesn't feel like that much. And then you get back to pay for what you've picked, and you go, oh, my God.
We just did tomato picking, apple picking, and pumpkin picking yesterday. I mean, we spent, I can't even tell you how much money we spent.
Well, it's like a drug once you get started. Not that I would know.
It's dangerous. But so I came home with all these blueberries and went, well, gosh, what do I do? And sort of that childhood training kicked in. I was like, well, I should make some jam. So I called my mom to remind me how to do it, and I ran out to a hardware store for jars, and I made my first batch. And I just loved doing it. There was something so satisfying about making something that lasts longer than, you know, the duration of an average meal. Mm-hmm. And so I started doing it. But the problem was that I was making jam and pickles in batches where I was yielding 6 or 7 or 8 pint jars. And I was doing that 2 or 3 batches a week because I was really loving making it. And it started to become really too expensive. And I had so much that I was not eating through that I went, okay, there has to be a better way. There has to be a way for me to continue to do this because I really enjoy it and not soon become sort of like a food hoarder.
Right.
And, you know, turn my apartment into, you know,
a wall of cans,
a small grocery store. Exactly.
Right.
And so so I started trying to figure out how to cut the recipes down. And so the nice thing about making small batches, it's not just that, you know, you need to start out with less produce. They take less time to make, but they're really not. It's, you know, people often ask me, well, if I'm going to go to the trouble of making a preserve, making a jam or a pickle, I want to have a lot. But when you make small batches, you're not really going to any trouble. You know, maybe it'll take 5 or 6 minutes to prep the fruit or the vegetable. It's not a lot of time or energy. So there's really no effort involved. You can just do it. You know, in some of the recipes, if you're making a quick pickle, all it is slicing up a cucumber to plopping it into a jar, adding some spices, and adding a little bit of vinegar, water, and salt.
Okay, but can I just tell you what my fear is? My fear is the seal.
Yeah.
That it's not, I love the idea, first of all, of doing small batch. I think that makes so much sense, and I think I understand the process. My concern is not doing it right.
Yes, because we her family, don't want to die.
Mr. Rancid food. How do you make that seal work?
So when you're doing a small batch, you know, you have a couple of choices. You can either, if you're making such a small batch where if it's only making one little jar, you don't even have to seal it. You can just put it in the refrigerator and eat it over the course of the next couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to seal it, you do need to do the boiling water bath process. But, and that, you know, people think that's a really scary thing. It really is simply you fill up the jar. If you're putting a hot product into the jar, you want the jar to be nice and warm, mm-hmm. so that the jar doesn't break from the temperature differential. You put a lid and a ring on it. You want to make sure you're starting with a new lid so that the sealing compound is really nice and fresh and elastic. And then you boil that jar. And most sweet preserves, so most jams and many pickles, it's going to be 10 minutes of boiling. And so for these little batches, when you're only yielding a jar or two, I like to use an asparagus pot as my canning pot.
That makes sense. Right, because it's
really small.
I have no idea what an asparagus pot
looks like. That's okay. She's speaking my language. Go ahead.
And so basically then you just put the one jar in the asparagus pot. It's already got that little rack, so the mm-hmm. water's going to be able to circulate around the jar. You bring the water to a boil. As soon as it hits the boiling point, you set a timer for however long the recipe tells you to boil the jar, and you take it out when the timer's up. It sounds scary, but I always tell people, if you can make pasta, you can.
Well, that makes me feel better about it. Okay.
All right. I might be the first person to disprove that because I can make pasta.
Yes.
But I can't.
But we don't let him, as a matter of fact.
So, but let me take you to another place because you are more than just somebody who loves canning. I mean, you got really into it. Your blog, I know Food in Jars is hugely popular. Mm-hmm. I mean, what was the transition to turning this, this passion into an industry? Because you've got two books out. Preserving by the Pint is number two, and you're driven in a different way than a lot of folks at home are who just like to can. What happened?
Well, it started.
What happened to you, Marisa?
What happened? I know. I started the blog 6 years ago, really looking for just a hobby, a project. I had been doing a little bit of professional food blogging, which I realize kind of does sound like an oxymoron, but I had been doing it freelance and a job was coming to an end, and so I decided I was just going to write about food for fun online. And I liked to can, and I wanted something to, to challenge me to do a little bit more. So I started the blog, not expecting that it was going to go anywhere, but canning got really hot, like 6 mm-hmm. years ago, and I was there. I didn't mean to be there. It wasn't this sort of, canning is going to get really hot, and I'm going to be there when it gets hot. I really was just doing it for my own fun and edification. And then people started asking me questions and approaching me for interviews when sort of everybody was suddenly talking about canning 6 years ago. And I embrace
just right place, right time.
Talk about timing. I'm thinking of hoping that sleeping catches on because I do a lot of that. I'll be writing about it.
He'll be very good at that. All right. We only have a couple seconds left. Tell us first.
We've got to take a break and then we're coming back.
Oh, we are coming back?
Oh,
terrific. Sorry, I wasn't paying attention. All right. Let us take a break. When we come back, we want to talk about some of the recipes in the book. So we'll be back in just a sec. This is David and Nikki Nellis with Foodie and the Beast. We'll be back in just a minute.
Did you know that birthday parties help build confidence in kids?
Yeah. Did you know that giving kids less sugar before bedtime helps them sleep better?
Oh, totally. Did you know that friendly kids have more friends?
Everybody knows that.
Hey, guys, did you know that most people think they're using the right car seat for their kid, but they're not?
I didn't know that.
Parents who really know it all know for sure that their child is in the right car seat at the right age and size. Visit safercar.gov/the right seat to make sure your child is protected. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
The federal government produces massive amounts of information every day, but most of it's useless beyond the agency that produces it because it's not available in a usable format. That's starting to change. With the passage of the Data Act, the first steps have been taken. But what's next? Join the Data Transparency Coalition and Workiva September 30th for Data Transparency 2014, the preeminent gathering of leaders from Congress, the executive branch, and industry to find out what's next for data transparency and open data. Register today at datatransparency2014.org.
This is Captain Richard Phillips. In 2009, my United States-flagged merchant marine vessel was boarded by Somali pirates. The U.S. Navy intervened and saved my life. Our nation's sea services keep the world's waterways open and help our nation's economy stay strong. Help support our Navy, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, and merchant marine so they can stay on the job by joining me as a member of the Navy League of the United States. Learn more at thenavyleague.org and donate through the combined federal campaign number 58495.
GovEvents.com is your one-stop shop for government and military events worldwide.
with hundreds of event organizers posting their government and military-related conferences, trade shows, expos, webcasts, and more, you'll save time and energy using GovEvents to find events to attend, exhibit, or sponsor. Search for government and military events by date, location, keyword, organizer, or focus. It's free, so join today. GovEvents.com. That's GovEvents.com.
We're back on Foodie and the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis. I just want to quickly remind everybody you can listen to us also streaming at federalnewsradio.com and online at realmnetwork.com. Mm-hmm. And we're talking to Marisa McClellan about canning. And Nikki was asking before the break about recipes.
I want to talk about some of the seasonal recipes. So, I mean, clearly tomatoes right now are an easy one, but what else can people be doing right now?
Well, as we're heading into fall right now, there's lots of apples and pears coming into season. Mm-hmm. I've got recipes for a maple sweetened apple butter in Preserving by the Pint, which is always a delicious one. Mm-hmm. There's a really great pear caramel that I like a lot in the book. Then we've also got Concord grapes right now, and I actually don't have a recipe in the book for Concord grapes, but they're so easy to use. All you need to do if you're going to get some Concord grapes is, you know, buy a couple pounds, cook them down with a little bit of water, push them through a sieve or a food mill, mm-hmm. and then measure out how much grape pulp you have, and then add half as much sugar, a little lemon juice, and cook it down till it's jammy, and that's it.
And that's it? And then you just put it in?
Yeah,
that sounds delicious.
It's really good.
Are there any ingredients that beginners should not touch? Is there anything we should stay away from when we first get started?
Well, there are things that are harder and things that are easier to mm-hmm. have success with.
So tartar steak, for example?
When you're working with cucumbers, it's really hard to make a really crunchy preserved cucumber pickle.
Oh.
And so if you want your cucumber pickles to be really crunchy and crisp, you don't want to run them through a boiling water bath canner. You want to make a refrigerator pickle out of them.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people, they'll make preserved pickles out of cucumbers and think, oh, well, I can't pickle because my cucumbers are soggy. Or they'll make strawberry jam and their strawberry jam is runny and they'll think, oh, I'm not a jam maker. Well, cucumbers and strawberries are two of the hardest ingredients to work with. So I always recommend to people that if they're starting out that, you know, this time of year, an apple jam is good. In the summertime, blueberry jam is good because they're both high in pectin, so you're going to have more success with those kinds of foods. Or if you're trying to make a really crunchy pickle and you want it to be preserved, a pickled green bean, like a dilly bean, is always going to pay off for you.
Okay.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we got to wrap up. I want to make sure everybody knows we're talking to Marisa McClellan, who is America's queen of canning, I guess is the way. Have you thought about using that
as a... Do you have a throne?
She's got a million readers at her blog and Food in Jars. I'm being slightly facetious, but not completely. And she's got a brand new book out called Preserving by the Pint, Quick Seasonal Canning for Small Spaces. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you this, because I, you know, Nikki gets a million literally. Now I'm not being figurative. Cookbooks a week into the house. And a lot of them, I'm not a cook at all, and I find them unreadable. Your book was terrific. And if I were going to can, which I probably won't have to because Nikki does, it's really great. It was a really step-by-step look, so it does make it easy for anybody who just wants to jump in and give it a shot. And everybody else in the studio is nodding. They're all going to go home and can. So, Marisa, where do we find the book?
The book is available wherever books are sold, so Barnes & Noble, Amazon, you know, wherever you buy books or order books. It's really just available.
And wait, are you coming to D.C.? For book signing, or did you already come to D.C.?
I already came to D.C.
You were here in August.
I did a demo at the Farmer's Market on Sunday morning at DuPont Circle.
Well, if you come back, will you let us know? Because we'd love to have you back in. There's a lot more to talk about
here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'd love to.
All right, Marisa, thanks so much. And again, the book is Preserving by the Pint. Go buy it. There you go.
Great. Thank you.
All right, Casper and Lauren, we're going to go back to you. So these two sodas are terrific. And again, soda sounds like it's going to be super sweet and sticky, and these did not come across that way at all.
No, it's just fresh fruit. It's just cooking the fruit down. It's natural.
Are you preserving it?
Naturally sweet.
Are you canning it?
No.
Do you have a can-do attitude, Casper? You either do or you don't. Spit it out.
We can.
Okay.
Yes, we can. That's the right answer.
What a great title for a book.
I know.
Oh, I'm going to steal that.
Okay, go ahead. What have we got next from you guys?
Okay. Lauren will talk about the next one.
No, Lauren doesn't want to talk to us.
Oh.
No, Lauren's giving up. Well, somebody better talk.
Yeah, I was going to make it.
Oh. I was going to make it.
Well, you can tell us about it. Don't worry, it's just live radio. Tick tock.
Great.
Guys, tell us.
So it's cranberry juice, rosemary simple syrup, fresh lime juice, and then I just added a little bit of this beer, which is a French red wine aperitif.
Okay.
We'll top it off with a little bit of Sprite and ginger beer just to cut out kind of the sweetness.
And what is the drink called?
It's on our menu is the Sophisticated Lady.
Okay.
Sophisticated Lady, that's
you. Sophisticated Lady.
And what is the liquor normally in it?
So you can do it with gin or vodka, just something simple, a lighter spirit.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a nice, like, refreshing little bit of tartness.
Let me ask you a question about vodka, all right? Are you guys fans of sticking it in the freezer so it's nice and cold and basically kills whatever taste is there? Or do you like it to be warm so that it can
vodka
be found
doesn't
in
have
the,
any taste.
Well, vodka has
I
a little
taste. I don't
do
warm vodka.
You don't?
Do you guys keep it chilled?
No, but we chill it.
Right, you chill it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think you guys are always chilling.
Okay.
Always chill it.
But what about gin? I mean, because gin has that juniper taste.
Gin should be stirred with ice.
Okay.
To have a slight chill.
Okay.
And not like shaken. I think everybody knows that. Shaking gin would bruise it. Do you want it a slight chill?
No, I have to be honest. Not everybody knows that. I don't think everybody knows that you can bruise gin. Is it that delicate?
It is. It's as delicate as your bourbon or whiskey.
Interesting. Very cool.
Who knew that? All right. Now we know. All right. Now we're going to get serious.
We're going to get very serious.
We're going to get serious. Catherine, step up to the mic. Catherine Miller is the founder of the Chef Action Network, or CAN.
Mm-hmm.
And welcome to Foodie and the Beast. Obviously, I'm the foodie, as you figured out. So start from the start. What is CAN? What's its mission? What are you guys up to?
Yeah, so thanks for having us. The Chef Action Network, otherwise known as CAN, is a project.
Uh-oh.
We lost you on the mic.
We're going to put you on a different microphone.
We're trying out a new mic.
There we go. Much better.
I just thought you were quiet.
Yeah. No, not at all.
No, not at all. Okay.
No, the Chef Action Network, we started officially last year. We were started with the support of several foundations, including the James Beard Foundation. And we train chefs to be better public policy advocates, to use their voice really strategically and powerfully on the issues that they care about in our food policy system.
Specifically, food issues, is it food in schools? Is it food in the grocery stores? Is it food served in restaurants? Is it food production?
I think that's a yes.
It's all of that?
Yeah, the chefs, we don't have a specific policy agenda. You know, we're not an advocacy organization on food in our schools. What we are is an organization that helps chefs decide how they best use their voice on the issues that they care about.
Mm-hmm.
And 99% of those issues are all related to our food system. So they're, how do you get better product into your restaurants? How do you get better product into schools? How do you bring down obesity rates? How do you tackle things like type 2 diabetes? How do you get people moving? A lot of the chefs first got into this world around the Let's Move campaign. So mm-hmm. it's the whole spectrum of our food system.
So how did you go about gathering the chefs for this? I mean,
do they enlist or do you proselytize?
Right.
We do a little bit of both now, but this started 2 years ago officially with the James Beard Foundation's Chefs Boot Camps for Policy and Change.
Mm-hmm.
This is a application that chefs fill out. We have over 500 applicants for the program now from chefs around the country. And we choose 15 chefs at a time. So that's a small, small number at a time. We've now done five. And we train them. We take them away for 3 days and we put them through advocacy boot camp. You know, we bring in experts to talk about issues. Mm-hmm. We bring in professional trainers to help better prepare them so they can do media interviews and use their social media. And then we do some work with the chefs themselves, the follow-on work of helping them actualize their own policy agendas. So we have a number of chefs who have gone through it here in Washington.
Who are the chefs who have been here?
Mike Isabella. Mm-hmm.
He's politically correct.
Yeah. That's what I said.
It's not about being politically correct. It's about being political.
He's not even correct.
So Mike Isabella, Spike Mendelson, Scott Druno, Cahal Armstrong, and then Jordan Lloyd, who's out at Bartlett Pear in Easton.
Yeah, in Easton. Yeah.
A bunch of nobodies.
Right.
Yeah.
But so did they come to you or did you reach out to them?
A little bit of both. Like I said, we have an application process for the boot camp. Mm-hmm. And so then we go through it and look for diversity in region, diversity in issues that they care about, gender, other things.
And then is there a commitment on their part once they get this training to actually go out and do something?
Yeah, it's the big thing that we ask them at the end. So we ask them to pick issues that they care about. And then the Chef Action Network goes and works with each chef individually.
So what does Mike Isabella care about?
Mike's been doing a lot of stuff. He did antibiotic reform, which was one of our first successful initiatives with the Pew Charitable Trust. He did some work on trans fats and donuts on the FDA reform related to getting trans fats out of our donuts.
Well, let's talk about the antibiotic platform. Sure. What was it that you guys were trying to accomplish with that?
Yeah, we wanted to. The Pew Charitable Trust launched a campaign called Superbugs, and the idea is to remove antibiotics from our food system, right? So we didn't, a lot of us probably didn't know that food producers were injecting antibiotics into eggs,
right,
into animals. And the idea was to keep the animals healthy, but the inverse was that it was having negative effects on the humans who were then consuming it. And so after many studies, after much review, we launched a campaign with Pew to reduce the level of antibiotics. And being in D.C., the home of policy, we can tell you that an FDA rule usually takes over 5 years to change, and we did it in 2.5.
Well, I was going to say, because now when you go anywhere, whether you're at a farmer's market or, you know, Whole Foods or any grocery store, I mean, it says on the chicken, it says, you know, no hormones, yeah, but, no antibiotics,
but isn't the broader issue that, I mean, in a sort of a boutique farm, in an intimate kind of a context, they can be antibiotic-free and keep everything clean and all that. But the antibiotics, my understanding is, because, you know, the mass producers of cattle or pork or anything, the places were so horrible in so many ways that if they didn't inject antibiotics into their animals, so many of them would die and sicken the others, et cetera, et cetera. So has there been any impact on them? Because they have to clean up their acts, I think.
Well, I think what you've seen now over the last 2+ years is a reduction in those mass producers using antibiotics. So everybody fell back on the idea that this will make the animals healthier, will produce, you know, prevent disease.
Yeah, but what
are
they doing to obviate the need for antibiotics? Are they cleaning up?
They're cleaning up.
They are?
Yeah.
They have to.
They have to. I mean, consumers are demanding it. Everybody from your Chipotle, which everybody goes to now.
Not
that has
my Chipotle.
Antibiotic, you know, free meat, hormone-free meat. So even the people that are buying your inexpensive burrito lunch are demanding this type of product, and some of that's been driven by the tastemakers, the chefs themselves.
Well, there's been a trickle-down effect, and as you and I were talking about off-air, I think chefs certainly have a different platform than they had even just 20 years ago, and these new chefs who are opening up these restaurants, they're not just feeding us, you know, great food, but they are, and it's not that they have an agenda, but they know so much now about sustainability and humane certified and good product that I think we're learning that from them. When we have it on our plate, we want to know how we can do it at home.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Chefs sort of have 3 or 4 places where they have strong advocacy voices. One is at the table, right? The decisions that a chef makes on what they put on their plate or what to put in their cocktails, right? That actually shows the customer something, starts to inform and educate them. Chefs are also big leaders in their community. I mean, if you look at even here in D.C., our chefs are economic drivers. Mm-hmm. They're employers. They are the drivers of local community systems related to how much you buy from farms. So they're leaders in those ways. And as you take those voices and look at how they can use them, they can then influence the national system. They can influence the state legislative system. Because guess what? Politicians want to be next to chefs. Chefs are cool. Chefs are the new rock stars.
Absolutely. So, wait, we're going to just pause you for a sec. We're going to come back.
A chef.
You're a little late in the game for that. All right. This is David and Nikki Nellis with Foodie and the Beast. We'll be back in just a sec.
Experience the Appalachian Trail like never before. On October 9th, for one night only, the film The Appalachian Trail, An American Legacy hits the big screen in D.C. Hear from exciting guest speakers like a retired astronaut and thru-hiker, and commentary from the film producer himself. Test your luck and win cool prizes. Kids get in for free. All proceeds benefit the Appalachian Trail. Reserve your seat at relivetheat.com. That's relivetheat.com. Enter AT14 for $5 off each ticket.
This is Mark Amtower. If you're looking for cost-effective and efficient methods for marketing your products or services to the government or to other government contractors, look to LinkedIn. There are over 400,000 members in the D.C. area and more than 92 million nationwide, but only a small percentage actually use it well. I can show you how to leverage LinkedIn in ways that support your marketing, sales, and business development efforts. I do this for large and small companies, and I can do it for you. Drop me a line at mark@federaldirect.net.
The federal government produces massive amounts of information every day, but most of it's useless beyond the agency that produces it because it's not available in a usable format. That's starting to change. With the passage of the Data Act, the first steps have been taken. But what's next? Join the Data Transparency Coalition and Workiva September 30th for Data Transparency 2014, the preeminent gathering of leaders from Congress, the executive branch, and industry to find out what's next for data transparency and open data. Register today at datatransparency2014.org.
Hey, Mom, why is the sky blue? Why don't animals talk? Why do dogs have wet noses? Why is an 11 pronounced 1T1?
Kids ask a lot of questions.
Why do I have a belly button?
But you don't have to know every answer.
Why is the ocean salty?
Because you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent.
Why are there 50 states?
There are thousands of children in foster care who don't need every question answered.
Why is pizza round?
They just need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
We're back on Fooding the Beast with Dave and Nikki Nellis. Before we get back to Catherine Cook and Ken, I just want to thank the folks that make this show possible, our friends at the Hyatt Regency Chesapeake Bay.
Mm-hmm.
What a resort. Holy cow.
Next week we have a whole show on them.
Well, would you let me do my thing?
Go do your
okay.
thing.
The Beef Checkoff, the Mandarin Oriental Washington, Georgetown Bakery. Best bagels in town, bar mm-hmm. none. Virginia Wine Board and the American Lamb Board. If you are not a sponsor of this show, shame on you. You should mm-hmm. be. So there. So let's get back to Catherine and Ken. You want to talk about your Nora dinner?
Oh, yeah. So last week.
Yeah, tell us.
Sorry. Last week, we hosted 350 people at Union Market, thanks to the folks at Eden's and a number of our sponsors. And we roasted, we had a number of celebrity roasters, including Patrick O'Connell from the Inn at Little Washington.
Who came in a Pope hat
and beatified Nora.
Mm-hmm.
And then Mary Sue Milliken with restaurants in L.A. and Las Vegas and a number of other folks. And the idea was that Nora is really an unsung hero in our organic movement. Mm-hmm. She gets a lot of attention here, but not necessarily nationally. Mm. And we wanted to pay tribute to her.
She was the first here in town to go organic.
Yeah, she really was.
Yeah, and she's one of the, you know, she was the very first certified organic restaurant in the country. Mm-hmm. And if you look around the country, the influence that she's had, everybody who is a certified organic restaurant came from Nora.
Right, it's thanks to her.
Yeah.
So Alice Waters was behind Nora? I mean,
and they were all alongside of each other.
Yeah, it was parallel as far as their histories go.
Yeah, and they chose very different paths, mm-hmm. right? So
one was very West Coast and East Coast, so totally different availability of product and produce.
Yeah,
So
it wasn't really a roast because there was nothing bad you could say, right?
Well, that's the thing. You know, what we realized is everything was nice about Nora. You know, chefs are pretty bawdy and pretty raw, and, you know, Nora's not one of those.
What a cop out. But actually, she is very nice. It's kind of hard to, you know.
Yeah.
What do you do?
So
you had a bunch of bodies there. You raised a ton of money for CAN.
We raised a great amount of money. All the proceeds went to benefit our programs. And some of those are things like the work that we'll do on 2015 in partnership with Share Our Strength and others on the child nutrition.
Well, so let's talk about like 2015. What are some of your big issues for 2015?
Yeah. So we're going to do a lot of work on the Child Nutrition Reauthorization Act, which is a big bill coming before Congress that mm-hmm. Looks at our school lunch and creates the standards around school lunch.
You mean our crappy school lunch?
Yes, are not so healthy.
But a lot of chefs are working, at least mm-hmm. in the D.C. metro area. I know Cajal Armstrong is very involved.
Yep.
So is Robert Wiedemeyer in bringing good food to the local schools.
Yeah, but it's harder than you think. I mean, to get really involved in a school system, you have to change procurement policies. I mean, mm-hmm. food politics is actually one of the few things that is a market-based solution. Right. Mm-hmm. So people start buying differently. People start selling differently. Then all the things change. And that so school lunch is one of those. And the dictates by the federal government that some people are not happy with actually force people to buy healthier food. Mm-hmm. Right. To go and buy local product, to buy organic, to buy antibiotic free. And so this act is coming up for reauthorization at this time next year in 2015. And so that'll be a big focus of our work. We'll also be doing a lot of stuff related to food policy councils. D.C. doesn't have a food policy council, doesn't have a food czar, which is kind of shocking to think
about.
That is
shocking.
In case you need
one. I'm surprised.
Yeah. But food policy councils.
Yeah, but the problem is when you have a food czar or any other kind of czar, they have to be given the power and the authority to do something other than yammer.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, one of the problems, particularly in this city.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that we've found locally is that the growing advocacy lever of the Food Policy Council. So it's everybody who comes together from the media to the chefs to the producers to the policymakers, and they come together and make those decisions and create sort of checklists and platforms, and then they push them through. It's happening in Nashville. It's happening in Hawaii. It's happening in Michigan. And hopefully it'll happen here.
That would be great.
Well, let's do this. For anybody who wants to get involved with CAN or find out more about it, give us all the nitty-gritty contact info.
So we're on Twitter at Chef Action. Mm-hmm. They can follow us there. The website is chefactionnetwork.com. And come send us an email and follow us on Twitter, and you'll find out more about how to get involved.
Okay. Well, keep us posted on what you're doing, because we'd love to have you back. Any new reforms or platforms you guys are, we'd love to talk about it and bring in experts to talk about it as well.
Right, awesome. That's great. Okay, great. Thanks for the invitation. Thanks.
Casper and Lauren.
Let's wrap it up, guys.
Well, Fiola has a pretty cool dinner coming up on the 30th.
Yeah, tell us about it.
It's going to be awesome. So Chef Fabio is going to go out with a group and hunt for wild game. And so the menu is going to read five courses.
Tell him to stay away from Kensington, Maryland, will you? Can he aim? Is he good at that?
I would guess so.
You better hope so. Okay.
Growing up in the Marque. So, it's going to be like a pheasant, a hare, some grouse, pine smoked venison, all going to be paired with Virginia's RDV Vineyards.
Oh, I love that wine. Beautiful wine.
Yeah.
Stands up pretty tall against the other Virginia wines, which is...
What is the date of that dinner?
It's going to be the 30th.
30th of October.
Of October.
Okay, great. So everybody should mark their calendars now for that. And will you be making cocktails or pairing wines? What's your role in all this?
So we've got wine pairings. We're going to be working with RDV, who has Master Sommelier Jared Slip. He and I have been talking off and on about it. And what he wants to do, because there's so much variation in vintages in Virginia, is to do their Rendezvous, which is a Merlot-focused wine, a couple different vintages because it's a little bit lighter, more approachable, young, and finishing with their headliner, the Lost Mountain wine, which is Cabernet-focused. It's really left bank versus right bank Bordeaux-style wine.
And for people who don't know what that means, can you explain that?
Sure. So left bank being kind of the more king of, in certain words, king versus queen. So Cabernet, left bank, Merlot, right bank in style.
I've never heard that before. That's so cool.
Maybe later you'll explain to me what he said. Something about Marie Antoinette in her head. I don't know.
And the dinner is going to actually be capped off at the end of the night with some Amadei Tuscan chocolates. And we're going to pair, I'm still sourcing, but we're going to find some rare Islay scotch, which is known, contradictorily, they're known for their peated style scotch, but I'm sourcing out some unpeated, so not smoked at all. Mm-hmm. So these Islay scotches have a really wonderful kind of salty, briny, seawater kind of affectedness to them. And without smoke, it really is amazing with chocolate.
And how much is it to get in on this, and how do we get reservations?
You can call Siobhan directly at Fiola, and it's $2.50 a person.
Mm-hmm. $2.50, right?
I think so. I have to double check.
Because that's my kind of meal.
I will be going and he will not.
I'll be there instead of you.
And where can people find you? Why don't you tell everybody where Fiola is and how they can find you at the bar?
Okay. Well, Fiola's, we're located at 601 Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And phone number being 202-628-2888. Mm-hmm. But also, everybody keep in mind, when you do visit the restaurant, our entrance is on Indiana on the opposite side of the building,
right,
which is very important.
It is, and you have valet parking, everything, right?
It's actually less expensive to
valet. For the old folks, is where Le Peridot used to be many years ago.
Very old folks.
Very old folks. Okay. All right, guys, thanks very much.
Thanks for having us.
All right, so unfortunately, the show is winding down, but everything you heard on the show today, plus Gobsmore, is available on the list, areyouonit.com. That's Nikki's website where you and 40,000 other folks around the area get all your little foodie news about Hummus House and about CAN and about everything else. You can also listen to Nikki on WTOP 103.5 today at 1240, right? There we go. And on Thursdays at something, 1:10, 1250, it moves around. What time?
Which one, Thursday or today?
Yeah, Thursday.
Thursday is 1210.
There you go, at 1210.
Today is 1240.
And you can follow her on Twitter, and I just like to follow her. So That's it. I'm done.
So next week's show is our, it's a double anniversary. It is our wedding anniversary, and it's our show's 6th anniversary. I can't believe we've been on that long. And we did take a trip.
And we're still married.
We're still married. This is really
every time
amazing.
We get ready for a show, we play You Bet Your Marriage, but yes. We're still married.
We're still doing it. Anyway, so we took a trip out to the Hyatt Chesapeake, which is on the Eastern Shore, and we had such a fabulous day there. And we talked to everybody. We talked to their lead chef. We went to
John
the
Harper,
pool.
The guy that runs their waterfront.
Go ahead.
I'm just saying. I'm a native Washingtonian. I've been driving down Route 50 to the beach for as long as there's been leaves on the trees, and we've passed that Hyatt sign and never driven in there. And when you go in there, you take your left off of Route 50, it literally becomes a whole other world.
It is. It's really beautiful.
It's marshland and